Hello and welcome to our podcast on negotiation. And today we have not one, but two guests, very special guests, Star Wars fans and negotiation professors, conflict resolution professors, Jen Reynolds and Noam Ebner. Guys, great to have you with us.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And instead of me introducing you guys, so let's change the rules of the game. How about if you introduce each other?
That sounds great. I'm happy to go first. It's my great pleasure to introduce my close friend and wonderful colleague, Noam Ebner. We have known each other for many years, maybe more than 10 years. And Noam is has been a professor at Creighton University in Omaha, where he was with the law school and then with the business school, because they were moving around the master's program in conflict resolution. He recently told us that he is going to retire from Creighton in the summer. So that's very exciting news. Sad for Creighton, you know, good for the Star Wars world, because we'll have more to him to ourselves. And he has four children. He lives in Florida. One of his children is a professional dungeon master, which I always think is such a cool fact. All his children are amazing, though, and his wife is incredible. Let me think. Oh, he teaches online. He's like an expert at online teaching. And so when the pandemic hit, he was in hot demand by everyone to try to figure out how we can teach our highly interpersonal subject matter over the internet.
And let me maybe, Jen, that's a great introduction. Thank you so much. Let me maybe add one more question to you before we transition, Noam, to you. I think in your new book, you wrote that you live in New Dagobah.
Who, me?
Noam.
Oh, Noam, yes. Yes, New Dagobah.
Yes. Is that Florida?
Yeah.
No. Florida is, yeah.
That's Florida and particular Jacksonville, which if you've seen The Good Place on Netflix, Jacksonville was introduced as one of the 10 top swamp cities in northeastern Florida. And essentially, you know, all of Florida is, it's a swamp with cities built on top of it. And you know, the swamp is constantly trying to come back. And large parts of it are essentially Dagobah.
All right, Noam, now it's time for your introduction of Jen.
So, Jen, yeah, I'm sorry, my connection is a little choppy. I apologize, and I'll try to improve it. But first, I'll just say that Jen Reynolds is the dear, dear friend. I'll start off by saying she used to dress up as Princess Leia on Halloween. I don't know for sure that she's stopped, but I know that she used to. She's also a professor of law and now interim dean at the University of Oregon School of Law. She teaches civil procedure and is also an expert on negotiation, mediation, dispute systems design, and a whole. Jen is a deep thinker on pop culture and what pop culture means with regard to society, with regard to individuals, and has been thinking on this for many, many years in a far more serious way than I have. And we discovered our joint love for Star Wars and our joint love of pop culture in general and our desire to do something with it in our field. And so this is the first thing that we started to do is writing books on it or editing books on it. Jen is also an amazing writer. I had the pleasure of writing a chapter together with her for this book, and it was just such a fabulous process.
And she lives on Ender.
she does. If you've ever been to Oregon, then you'll realize why it's Endor. She lives in Endor. She has three children, two of whom are twins, mm-hmm. and about 4,000 cats and dogs.
It's true.
All right, guys, thank you so much. It seems that you guys know a lot about each other. I mean, no wonder. Two big projects together, right? Star Wars and Conflict Resolution 1, which was a bestseller, and then a sequel, which has just come up. Star Wars and Conflict Resolution 2, My Negotiation Will Not Fail. And this is what we're going to be talking about in the next couple of minutes. But let's start at your with your first association. When you guys hear Star Wars, what is your immediate first association with it? Let's start with Noam this time.
Yeah, so I can say that my first association is family. My first association, I flash back to my father taking me and my brother to see it in a theater, 1977. And up to this day, I mean, up to yesterday, it's been Star Wars weekend all weekend. I saw The Phantom Menace in theaters, and I saw Rogue One in an open air theater out in the grass, and it was all with family surrounding, and it's something we do together, something we talk about. It's a way we can talk about all of the topics going on in the world through the metaphor or the reality of Star Wars. So I think family.
Family, all right. No, would never associate Star Wars with family, but hey, we share exactly the same experience, Noam. The Return of the Jedi was my first, the first movie at a movie theater that I saw with my dad as well. Yeah. So Jen, how about yours?
Well, that's such a great answer, because the first thing I thought of was seeing A New Hope in the theater, and my brother just running up and down the aisles of the theater during the trench run with his arms out like an X-Wing. And I remember that really fondly, you know, just like him making these little noises, and that we just we loved Star Wars so much as kids. I collected many, you know, those little figurines. I collected sets. We played Star Wars in the yard with our friends. It was formative in a way that's almost impossible to really capture. And when the The Empire Strikes Back was a movie that I saw many times, and loved so much. I had a huge poster of the four people sitting in the Millennium Falcon on my wall as a kid, and Return of the Jedi, of course. And so it's the association I have is childhood. That I just remember, just think of it as this piece of my childhood that was so precious to me and so beautiful and something that linked me with so many others.
Family, childhood, thank you so much, guys. But now we have to towards something which is less pleasant than family and childhood, and that's the conflict, right? Because when I was writing the
announcement, how about you, Remy?
My association? It's the smell of the movie theater.
Mm-hmm.
It's when I think about Star Wars, it's kind of a, I don't know, I don't want to say it's a little bit humid with mothy kind of, you know, like movie theaters, old movie theaters, not the new ones, the mega new ones, hyper movie theaters. But this smell I still associate with Star Wars for some reason. I don't know. But it's still there. It's still our first experiences, family, childhood, and this funny smell at an old movie theater. Yeah. All right, and I do have in my WhatsApp picture, I'm still wearing a Darth Vader mask. So, all right, let's move on. Let's move on to conflict. The whole nature, the whole, let's say, the whole nucleus of Star Wars franchise is conflict of various on various various layers, various levels, and what is the root cause of this conflict? What do you guys think? Let's start with Jen this time.
The root cause of conflict in Star Wars. So it's a good question, and you know, I was thinking about it. There's so many different answers that we could give, but I'm going to say that I think in Star Wars, maybe at least one root cause of conflict is the desire to control. It's simply a desire for power and control. You know, who's going to make the decision? There's this giant universe of difference and people and things and it's a clash between visions of who should control and how. And so you've got the Sith on the one hand, they have this idea of like a top down, you know, one person in charge and with the one apprentice below. And then you've got the more sort of democratized republic, you know, sharing power a little bit more, but there's variations just throughout around, you know, around power and control that leads to, I think, the conflict. I don't know if it's the root cause, but it's certainly one of the, if it's not the root cause, it's definitely one of the most prevalent symptoms.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Jen. Noam, anything to add?
Well, I'll just say that at first it seems as if the root cause of conflict is because there are evil people and they're doing bad stuff. And you need to stand up and fight against bad people. So the root cause is evil or the desire to do well. I mean, that's what we thought between 1977 and 1983. And then it turned out when the sequels came out that just as Jen described, that it's much grayer, and that there are two or more viewpoints on what this whole thing is about. And that in the end, you know, just as Jen put it, that it's about control. And you know, that's what Palpatine said. He said, like, it's all about the Jedi as well. Like, all those who have power seek to maintain it. And that's what this whole thing is about. I find it interesting that Star Wars also provides sort of internal explanations as to why conflict is so prevalent. Why is this all happening? Like, so Anakin tells Shmi Skywalker, like, you always say that the worst thing in the galaxy is that nobody helps one another. That's why we have conflict. And Palpatine explains that, you know, that the Republic is doomed and the conflict is spreading because there's no interest in the common good anymore. And so we have these very different characters offering these in-story explanations for why we have so much conflict in the galaxy. I find that interesting. Any of those could explain why we have so much. Good explanations.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you. Thank you guys for sharing this. I was wondering, you know, one of the reasons for the intensity and frequency of conflicts in the galaxy was the fact that they didn't have such great negotiation and conflict resolution professors like you guys are. but then I looked it up, the statistics on the prevalence of conflict in our modern era, and it seems that we're having more now than we've ever had before. which is kind of surprising, but it's saddening at the same time, right? I mean, despite all this research that we've all invested into helping each other understand the nature of conflict, its root causes and possibilities to resolve it, at the end of the day, we cannot prevent it. Isn't that sad?
It is.
Maybe we don't have enough Jedi knights in our
thing.
Times.
We seem to be becoming more and more immersed in conflict. But when you think about where we are at this point in human development and history, arguably, this might be the most peaceful time humanity has ever known. And I think that's really surprising. Particularly it's surprising, you know, in the past couple of years when we've been moved backwards, perhaps to the brink of another hot, cold war. The past 6 months in Israel and Palestine, like, it seems that the world is on fire. But when you zoom out and you actually look at incidents of conflict going on around the world, actually it's not so bad compared to, you know, how we were 100 years ago and 200 years ago. And so I always wonder, you know, which of those lenses to apply. Things really seem pretty bad from a conflict viewpoint right now. And then there's also this optimistic view. Maybe it's based on hope that things are getting better.
Let's hope so. So moving on, you guys, back to the book. Yes, you guys decided to for a subtitle, which is My Negotiation Will Not Fail. Yes, can you share why?
Well, that's a line from Attack of the Clones, and Palpatine says to the, you know, they don't know that he's the bad guy. He says to his little gathered group of people that he's going to try to keep the Republic from getting split into two by the dreadful separatists and the Trade Federation, and his negotiations will not fail. And so when we were thinking about the subtitle, we were drawn to that because it has such a double meaning. Cause of course he's playing the game, you know, he's got his long con going. And so in a way it's impossible for him to fail. Even if he fails, he's really succeeding. Even if he succeeds, he might be failing. So it's sort of a meaningless statement in some ways, but we thought it was a really great, line for us to talk about what it means for to be successful in negotiation. Does it mean that you came to a deal? Does it mean, you know, that the dispute ended? It doesn't necessarily mean any of those things, because success in negotiation is really very situation dependent. It depends on what people are looking for. It depends on what people can offer. It depends on the conflict or the decision at hand. And sometimes the best decision and the most successful outcome would be just to walk away with nothing. And in that sense, it would be a failure, but that failure would also be its success. And so we wanted to highlight that aspect of negotiation. And so thus we chose Palpatine's sinister line.
All right. So let's take Palpatine now and compare him. Now, for viewers and listeners, we're going through the consecutive chapters in the book. That was, by the way, the first chapter, explaining the subtitle, it's called, the book is called My Negotiation Will Not Fail. And now let's move on to the next one and contrast a little bit the leadership and negotiating style of Palpatine, which we've just invoked, and Padme. Who can we learn more from? Palpatine or Padme? What do you guys think?
I think we can learn more from you, Remy. let's put this out straight. Remy wrote the excellent, amazing chapter comparing leadership styles of Palpatine and Padme, and in particular with regard to negotiation styles and how that was one aspect of their leadership styles. And I'll be honest, this was... Jen, I wonder if you'll agree. This was one of the best reasons to edit the book and to invite other people to write chapters in the book along with us, as opposed to writing a book on Star Wars and negotiation ourselves. I would never have thought, Remy, I would never in a million years have thought to contrast Padme and Palpatine and to recognize that they have both so much in common and they have completely opposite leadership styles, and that there's so much to learn from the contrast. And so why don't you tell us what you think?
That's a nice way of answering a moderator's question, right? I got him.
is that what you are here?
Yes, exactly. I thought I would just, you know, stand here and keep asking questions, but then you forced me to answer my own question. Yes. But first of all, the credit belongs to Jess Salacus, who a couple of years ago wrote an excellent piece on leaders as negotiators, I think that's a research area which he was very involved in, at least in the last couple of years. And we sort of looked at the book and his framework and thought about, let's take two very distinctive leadership personalities such as Palpatine and Padme, and compare their effectiveness. Yes, and consequences thereof. Yeah. And when we started, by the way, the book, also credit belongs to Jan, who co-authored this chapter, my son. I hope he's watching or listening us right now. But anyway, when we started discussing it, we discovered for ourselves that the answer to this question is not obvious at all. Yes, because ultimately, when we look at Palpatine, we look at someone who has been super successful as a leader, right? I mean, of course, he almost destroyed half of the galaxy at the end, right? But and killed many, many creatures along the way. But in general, he achieves his objectives, which is ruling the galaxy. Yeah, he becomes the emperor at the end, right? So he is claiming and sustaining power, at least until it's corrected by the rebels, right? So, but then we looked at Padme, who was also a very successful senator, also leader of her planet. But at the end of the day, she doesn't reach her goal. Yes, she fades away, right? Her leadership styles require so much energy that she doesn't have. Yeah? So we might argue, well, Palpatine, we might disagree with his methods, but certainly we cannot deny the effectiveness, right? And on the other hand, we might sympathize with Padme's methods, yes, with Padme's leadership style, but at the end of the day, we feel sorry and we pity her because at the end of the day, she doesn't reach her goals, right? The question is, you know, to what extent can leadership style can be judged by the obtained results? And to what extent other aspects, such as, you know, Jen, and your answer to my previous questions, there are other dimensions that that need to be considered while evaluating somebody's, be it negotiation success or leadership style, such as, you know, the impact on others, yes, and what happens with those others if they become followers, yeah, to what extent they become inspired, to what extent they do it out of fear, and so on and so on. So it was the answer was not obvious, and we thought the topic where with non-obvious answers is a good topic for research for a potential chapter.
Yeah, it was great.
Yeah, it makes me wonder whether the comparison is one comparison that is a strict comparison of leadership styles, and that was something wonderful that you and Jan did. It also makes me wonder what would have happened if Padme had never met Anakin, or if the Emperor had been distracted by a high maintenance, volatile, you know, self-absorbed, significant other. Might some of the issue at hand be not that their leadership style was better in the sense of how could it achieve, but simply that Padme was distracted. She was greatly distracted by Anakin always getting in her way, but on an emotional level and on a practical level. And Palpatine was not distracted by anything, didn't let anything get in his way. So it might not be that there's only leadership style, but there's also relational elements sort of that mix in here.
There is.
I think that the relational elements are also in some ways a choice made in determining what leadership style you're going to take. So, you know, if you are Palpatine, you're going to not have any kind of close connections because you don't want to be distracted and you don't want to be, you know, and so even your apprentice exists in a very uneasy tension with you. Obviously, you don't trust him or her or them at all. So, and whereas, you know, Padme's leadership style was so inclusive and was so heartfelt and genuine, it makes sense that she would have distracting interpersonal relationships, and that maybe that was part of her strength too. I mean, the fact is that even though the Emperor does get Anakin, you know, he not forever, and you know, ultimately the tables turn. It's too late for Padme in the sense that, you know, she has died, but you know, she lives on in those children, and she and the legacy that she built, it endures, even though, you know, it undergoes. So I think that there's, I think it's right to bring up this relational piece as core to the leadership choices that they both make. So yeah, it's very interesting.
We had a lot of fun. Let me blend in Jan's comment. He's watching us. So yes, Jan, thank you so much for working on this project together. It was a lot of fun. Let's move on to the Jedi. Yeah, let's move on to the Jedi next chapter. And with all this training, with a Jedi Academy, with, you know, becoming an apprentice at a very early age, once the number of what's the name of those little particles that indicate the strength of the Force?
Midichlorians,
exactly. Thank you, Jen. Once the number of the threshold of midichlorians has been exceeded, they undergo systematic training to sustain peace in the galaxy, but ultimately they fail. Yes. Is it because they didn't have a negotiation course, or is it because in all this lightsaber swinging left and right, they forget to teach them how to resolve conflict or how to mediate it? What do you guys think? Jen, let's go with you first now.
Well, definitely it's that negotiation course. If only they would have had negotiation at the Jedi Academy. No, it's honestly, I think that I don't know that I think they failed. I think they didn't constantly succeed, but they, and even though Yoda said there is no try, the Jedi tried. They weren't perfect. They missed lots of things. They didn't notice, for example, that Palpatine was the Emperor, or the Darth Sidious, you know. They didn't notice any of this, and they were distracted by their own politics and their rules. And so certainly there is some conflict between this idea that you're going to be great at fighting but also peaceful. You know, these are just two, these ideas sit kind of uneasily together. But really, the stuff that they put into motion, just like Padme, you know, she fails too, but they were close enough. You know, they were doing enough of the right stuff to, I think, put enough things into place that ultimately we get to what we might think of as a happy ending of the saga. So yeah, I think there's lots of failure, but I don't think it's failure with the capital F. I think it's continued efforts, and that's the lesson I really want us all to take from the Jedi's experience, that you don't have to be perfect. I mean, it'd be better if you could do, of course, better in any moment, but that what's important is to just keep pushing in that right direction.
Is that what you think, Noam, as well?
Well, I'd say yes, but, or yes, and, or rather, let me piggyback on that and say, you need to sort of augment that with always remembering that the greatest teacher failure is. And so if you only just keep trying, but you keep pushing with the same tools, and this, making the same efforts, you're going to keep failing. I know that Einstein didn't exist in that galaxy, but you know, but that's right. And I think that the Jedi made that mistake of just trying to do the same thing over and over again. I've often wondered that how amazing is it that that the Jedi, that Qui-Gon and Obi-Wan didn't notice that Padme and the queen weren't the same person. Here was this major deception going on right around them by non-force users. Okay, there's no shroud of the dark side blinding them. And they fooled them. And that look they gave each other when they suddenly realized that, whoa, how didn't we get it? And it was just this weekend, sitting in the Phantom Menace back in theater, that I thought again about that moment. And I thought, wait, this isn't only an individual moment happening here. This is actually a foreshadowing of, hey, sometimes people aren't whom they seem to be. Sometimes people disguise themselves as other people, lie about who they are, and we should get better at recognizing them. But they didn't. And so they didn't recognize that Palpatine and Sidious are ultimately the same thing. And they're, you know, and that's a Padme Amidala thing. And I think that in many other ways, they kept using the same tool. And so if they're, I don't think there was a negotiation teaching in the temple. I once had, you know, the idea of writing sort of a first person novel type thing of a negotiation teacher in the temple.
What a great idea, Noam. What a great idea.
Go ahead and steal it. Okay. If you're that kind of writer, go ahead and steal it. But I don't think there was a negotiation. I think someone once said it and the other said, no, let's just dedicate more time to Jedi mind tricks. And that's all we need.
Wow. Yes, and that's maybe also a lesson for us today, right? I mean, we should keep on doing what we're doing, right? Despite what's going on around us at the moment, because maybe we are setting the right things in motion, as Jen, as you put it, right? I mean, maybe the people that we're helping understand conflict better right now will become the part of the resolution at some point in the future. Great. So let's talk. One of the next chapters talks about great places to work. So would you rather work for the Republic, Trade Federation, the Empire, the Alliance, the Rebels? What do you think? This time, let's start with Noam this time.
Well, it's quite pertinent to me because I'm on the market now, so I might actually have to make that decision. Well, here's one thing. One is, I'm not crazy about working for institutions. I mean, I've done it often and for a long time. But when you work in organized workplaces, you are certainly going to spend a certain amount of your time, not necessarily of your choice, engaging in conflict, some of which is important to you and some of which is not important to you at all. Mm-hmm. I think anybody, okay, I'm seeing the recognition nods. Perhaps you work at a university or in other places. And that takes a toll. It takes a toll immediately on time and attention, and it can take a toll long-term. And in that sense, I don't think, for instance, in our case, I don't think any university is much better than any other university, or I don't expect any particular university as a workplace to be much better at dealing with that than any other university as a workplace. And the same goes for these alliances, federations, and whatnot. So there's an excellent chapter in the book by a group from the University of Kennesaw who are writing about how each workplace had its own problems. It's not that either of them were better, but comparing the rebel alliance and the empire. And so sure. The empire seems to be a much worse place because, you know, if you said the wrong thing to the wrong person, you could be force choked. And we don't really see that happening on the rebel side. But on the other hand, when you watch Rogue One, you realize that the rebellion was really a pretty crappy place to work. And we see that in TV shows, like in Ahsoka. You know, people who are pretty high up in the rebel ranks, and they get put down, they get insulted, they get harassed, they can't do their mission, people get in their way. And so I'm not sure that any of these are, as far as conflict, is any better than any other. Of course, you want to work in a place that's aligned with your own personal mission. And so, you know, so that's easy. I'm not an empire guy in terms of my mission in the world. Turns out that I tried some time in the Trade Federation type world, working in a business school. I can do that. But I also know that the fact that you might be working for the Rebel Alliance or someone that you know is aligned with your mission doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be fighting any less.
Jen, what do you think? Now you're attending one of those federations, right?
That's right. For me, I was really trying to figure this out before when you asked it. I think that I've worked in a lot of different places, and I think that the real trick is to figure out how you do end up living your values, so to speak, in the context that you're in. And so I could imagine actually working in any of these places, but my role would change. You know, it's important to have, you know, people who are interested in sustainable business practices be in the Trade Federation. You know, we need to have people who would be able to argue that position to the people making decisions around how we're going to use resources and supplies. It's important to have people who are institution builders in the Republic, or it's important that the Alliance, you know, learn how to not take advantage of its workers the way we saw in Rogue One. So there's and you know, the Empire, we only have our good results in our story because there were people working for the Empire who sabotaged it. And so if those people aren't there, then we don't necessarily have a good outcome. So there's, it's, so there's just, so I think that it's kind of like you just, you find yourself in a place, you know what it is that how you're oriented, what you want, what your values are, and you figure out where that fits. So I think, of course, the empire would be the hardest one, but yeah.
I could totally see you, Jen, as ombudsperson on the Death Star.
You know, it sounds pretty good. It sounds like a kind of fun gig.
Right. Looking at the colors of our sweaters and shirts, our viewers have clearly figured out which side you guys of the force you guys are on, right? And talk about the rebels and the alliance as much as you want, right? You are on the dark side. All right. So since we've moved to the dark side, guys, what does it mean to negotiate like a Sith? Next chapter. Let's start with Jen this time, if that's okay for you guys.
No, it's fine. So this is a very fun chapter in our book, and it's all about, you know, that we have this distinction that sometimes we talk about between a cooperative style and a competitive style. And cooperative styles are very relational, and you know, make sure everybody gets what they want. And competitive styles are much more, I'd like to get the biggest piece of the pie. And so in this chapter, we talk about what is described as our author Troy Stearns talks about the ultra competitive style, which is the Sith style, which is not only do I want to get what I want, but I want you to not get anything at all. I would like you to utterly fail. And that's part of my goal is this sort of, so it's this uber dominance that reflects, that we see reflected by the Sith. And yes, color of the lightsabers. That's what's meant in the chapter. And what it does in the chapter, what Troy does is he thinks about the way these Sith kind of negotiations, if you could even call them that, obviously they're just struggles for control and power, how they play out. And he explores how they're kind of a high risk, high reward sort of enterprise, because obviously you can get everything you want and you can vanquish your enemy, except for when you don't, and then you yourself, you know, are going to be the one that gets thrown down the power shaft. So it's kind of an ultra competitive style of negotiation.
But maybe it's a consequence of the workplace, right? That they are at, right? Maybe it's a chicken and egg sort of a thing. To be successful on the Death Star, maybe you have to be very competitive. Noam, what do you think?
Well, it's both that workplace dynamic, but it's also further back in the philosophy of being a Sith. Now, I'm just wearing a black shirt. Doesn't mean I know the philosophy of being a Sith deeply, but the idea, and the idea of the rule of two is that, you know, there's one to hold power and one to crave it, and that's the way it's structured. So at some point in your life, you're always the one craving power, and then once you have that power, you're competitive in holding on to it, and failure means your life. So I could see why anyone would become not only competitive but ultra competitive under this. Now, the question of why you take that out into the world and you use that as your negotiating philosophy in every interaction you have. And when I say every interaction, so Darth Vader negotiates that way with Lando Calrissian, okay? Changing the deal, right? We have chapters on it. Troy's chapter in this book and a chapter by Hilary Elfenbein and Bill Bottom in the previous book. Definitely a fan favorite scene. And Darth Vader, you know, he pushes it and pushes it and pushes it. And he gets everything that he demands, but it ultimately sort of blows up in his face. And so that's one way of looking at it. But you wonder why, you know, Anakin, as on his way to the dark side, and then after he's become Darth Anakin, he uses that same ultra competitive approach with Padme, which is a lot less intuitive. And so I think that one thing that the Sith generally lacked, although Darth Vader got better at it with age, was the ability to turn it off.
Contextualize it a little bit, right?
Palpatine knew how to turn it off, but only, you know, when he was wearing his Palpatine clothes.
That makes sense. So when I was thinking about our chat yesterday or 2 days ago, I sort of I thought about the balance of power, yeah, and the fact that you know, maybe Star Wars for about 3/4 or maybe 2/3 or 3/4 of the franchise sends a wrong message, because the message seems to be that the dark side is stronger. Didn't you guys have that impression that for the major part of the franchise, the message that it's sending is that, hey, listen, come to the dark side, because, you know, when you join us, you're going to be stronger. What do you guys think about it, Jen? Let's start with you this time.
I think that the show is set up to always have us starting. The dark side is stronger because our hero is always going to be like the underdog or the person that's going to go on the journey. So we're always struggling to overcome the dark side. So I do think it's set up that way. I think it's also intuitively true that many situations, it seems like, selfish people are in charge, you know, people who don't care about the masses are in charge. And so I think that accords with our just our own lived experience, and thus, you know, makes for a good dramatic story. You know, how do we live in a world where it seems like bad people are running the show? So to that extent, I agree with you. The movies do make it seem like the dark side is stronger. Just to build on it a little bit, they also really valorize Darth Vader. Everybody's favorite character is Darth Vader, and, you know, I'm no exception. There's something so awesome about him, and even when he's still being very evil. I'll never forget when I saw him in Rogue One, that thrilling scene where he just comes and, you know, destroys everybody at the end. And he's the bad guy. So this, you know, so there is. Also, you know, the appeal of villains is just a real thing, and so I think that accounts for at least some of that lack of balance. There's both a reflection of some of our life and also the romance we have with the villain.
Mm-hmm. So Noam, do we need the dark side to keep the balance? Well, do we need the dark side to restore peace?
You could talk about this on sort of a Star Wars level or an Our World level. Let me for a change take this to an Our World level, just for a change. In the Star Wars world, yeah, you need both of them. That's how balance happens. In Our World, I think it's more an issue of that, practically speaking, that's the way we are. It is human nature. And maybe this is what Star Wars is also saying, essentially. That we have these, to the extent that the dark side has to do with our own inner world, and it's our own urges and compulsions and desires and decisions, you know, what we give into, what we don't. The things we associate with the dark side exist in all of us. And, you know, and it's hard to root it all out by saying, no, we're going to take a person and somehow program them to be only good. It doesn't really work, because that person who's really good, they still might want the last piece of cake and that might not want to share it with anyone. Just because, you know, we like cake. It's human to like cake. And I think that in that sense, the question of do we need the dark side is not necessarily the question of human nature. It's the dark side is with us, and it's a question of how we cope with it. Who we let drive the bus. How much do we recognize that occasionally, you know, expressing dark side ideas or emotions or giving into dark side is human. And I think perhaps that the more we recognize that that's human, we'll also be able to recognize something that the movies, or at least the dark side in the movies and the Jedi in the movies, never fully recognized, which is that you can give into the dark side once and then come back. And there's another chapter on that in the book about the absolutist view of the Sith and the Jedi of the Sith is that neither the Sith nor the Jedi could imagine that you could turn to the dark side and then come back. Once you go down that path, forever will it dominate your destiny. Bam, it's done. And Alon Burstein wrote a chapter for the book about how that was the one thing that the Jedi and the Sith agreed on. And the only person who didn't agree on that was Luke Skywalker, who was annoying everybody and saying, no, there's still good in him. There's still good. Okay, yeah, sit down, continue your training. And Luke believed that people could be redeemed. And so the dark side is with us, but we also need to remember that the dark side is not, it's not the end of the story.
Thank you so much. Cheryl Hayes, who is also one of the chapter authors, he says that the dark side is not stronger, but it's just a quicker way to power. Right. But once we attain power through dark side, it causes certain imbalance, which needs to be restored by reallocating or reshifting some of it to the light side. Yeah. That's a great view and a great summary of our discussion on which side is stronger. And it's not that we're advocating for all of you guys out there to join the dark side, right? definitely not. But it might be. These are the shortcuts where we somehow have to. We're facing the trade-offs. Yes, moral, ethical standards versus additional benefits, right? Economic benefits, right? Is it the dark side or the or the light side that is attracting us, and which path leads to more power quicker, right? So that's something that we need to leave our viewers and listeners with, and let's focus on Luke. Is Luke a hero? What do you guys think, Jan?
Oh, I think he absolutely is a hero, but and I'm glad that Cheryl brought up the acolyte. I'm very much looking forward to seeing that too, Cheryl. But Luke is a hero, but he's not perfect. So one of the things I think is beginning to emerge as a theme in this discussion today is that there is that we are imperfect beings attempting to do good in this world. You know, it's not anything, we can't control every aspect of how a situation unfolds or what happens, and all we can do is put our best efforts forward. And I feel like Luke is our example of that. He is, he has a lot of flaws. He's very impatient. He gets angry a lot. He sometimes can get kind of, as we saw in the sequels, he gets pretty surly. He's disaffected and resentful and you know, really jaded by the time it all comes to he meets Rey, and in this way he's very much like us. And at the same time, Luke also, he's so talented, he's got, you know, this incredible set of skills, he has this boundless optimism. You know, they can rescue the princess, I can shoot the torpedo into the thing on the Death Star, I can do it, you know. And he's and like Noam just said, he believes that Darth Vader can be redeemed. And that's something that nobody believed, not Yoda, not Ben, nobody believed this, and he was right. And I think Luke represents the extraordinary potential in all people, you know, that he's just this person, but that he is at bottom a person, you know, with all baggage that comes along with being that, and his journeys through the story, you know, his journey in the original trilogy, his journey then in the sequel, really illustrate the journey of a hero.
I guess we have to put a large exclamation mark behind that statement, Noam, and let's have a look at Chewbacca. Does he deserve his own medal? What do you guys think, Noam?
Well, there's the official line, which is that Wookiees don't like medals. But then there's the reality of things, which is everybody likes to be asked if they want a medal, at the very least. And so, of course, if you're giving out medals, you think that you should give them out to everyone. And that injustice, once you see it in, you know, watching A New Hope, you can't unsee it. And you start looking at the good guys a little differently. at the whole movie a little differently, but also at the good guys. Maybe the good guys, they have some of that bias baked into them just the same as the bad guys do. And so fans like to talk about that. Josefina Rendon wrote a chapter about that, about implicit bias and explicit bias in the Star Wars universe for our book. It's an eye-opener. Another thing is that, you know, think about how hard Chewbacca works to make people understand him. And yet he's very good at it. You always understand where he's going. But he has to work extra hard because, except for Han and a little bit Leia later on, humans don't bother to figure out a way to interact with him. And so he needs to work extra hard at that. And despite that, you know, he does everything that any of the humans in the show do. And nobody said, "Hey, thanks, Chewie." It's like, that's a line that doesn't exist. "Hey, thanks." Even when he gets wounded, in the sequels, he gets wounded. And there's that, it's a wonderful scene where he's being bandaged by a nurse or a doctor at the at the resistance base, and the doctor says to him, "I'm sure that must have been very hard. I'm sure you must have been very brave." And it's a delightful moment cinematically, but there's also something condescending to it, because as if she were bandaging an Ewok, "You poor little thing." But in the end, here's a being who has done everything in the movie that any other human has done, but doesn't receive any of the credits, any of the gratitude, or just any of the recognition. Like, "Hey, that was a good shot," right? And so it makes me think about, in my own life, who am I missing? Who am I treating as if they're, just sort of the fixtures, right? And not seeing them. For instance, in Star Wars, it took me a few years between seeing that Chewie didn't get a medal until realizing that actually R2-D2 was there for every minute of that trip as well. And, nobody would ask, people would say, "Why didn't Chewie get a medal? But what about R2? And so, who's next? What else aren't we seeing?
Might have been a problem with hanging it on his neck.
Answer: magnetic medals.
Magnetic medals, exactly. So yes, it seems that support from people who've always been there, we just kind of sometimes take it for granted, right? They are there because we think it's their job to help, whereas they might also enjoy certain tokens of appreciation. And Gordon mentions that Chewie got his medal in the 1980 Marvel comic. Is that right?
That's very cool. That's a cool piece of information.
A group of rebel emissaries traveled to Kashyyyk and presented in the medal, but not in the movies.
Not in the movies, right, exactly. So guys, if you have any more questions, please include them in the chat. What do you guys think about the gray side of the Force? Should there be a gray side of the Force, or do we need to have dichotomous absolutisms, white, black, Jedi, Sith? What do you guys think, Jen?
Well, I think that, setting aside the whole gray Jedi, debate, I think that it seems like there's always been a gray side to the Force. It's just the fact is that no person is going to be all of one thing, as we've said before, and it's more a decision you make around what your orientation is going to be toward life. What values are you going to bring to a certain situation, and that might end up pushing you to do things that may or may not be consistent with the code. I think that the Jedi code itself is itself sometimes kind of hard to parse in terms of one's values. Just as an example, the fact that you can't have any attachments, this seems to me to be inconsistent with a love of humanity, so it's or of others, and so it ends up putting you in this sort of a weird position. So I think that, yeah, so that's, I think it's just sort of, it's a feature of just life, and it's a matter of how people are going to orient themselves. But if you are explicitly a gray Jedi, I mean, I think that that ends up being a very interesting subject position. And I have heard that, you know, we might be seeing more of that, you know, in future programs, but we'll see.
Noam, is that what you think as well?
You know, there's this moment in The Mandalorian where some Mandalorians take off their helmet and Mando says, "Whoa, what are you doing?" And they look at each other and they say, "Oh, he's one of them." and you know, and you realize all of a sudden that he has been part of this sort of ultra traditional wing of the Mandalorian. And often I wonder whether that's not what we're seeing actually in the prequels. Maybe the Jedi at the end, toward the end of their Jedi orderness, maybe what we're seeing is the sort of ultra orthodox Jedi who, this is how they run things, and they have a strict code, and they perhaps punish people who stray from the code. But there, along the lines, there were other people who acted otherwise. And in the expanded universe, there are all sorts of examples of sort of other groups of Jedi who had other approaches to this. And so, you know, that's the Jedi way is one way to be a Jedi, it seems to me. I don't think it's one that I could have followed. Or let's put it another way. I have to believe in a gray Jedi, because otherwise I don't fit in.
There you go. It's much easier to have it that way. All right, guys, we're slowly approaching our deadline, our time limit. I think we've gone through at least 8 or 10 chapters right now, and had great philosophical discussions about various aspects of the Star Wars franchise. What would you guys like your readers to take out after they've purchased your book, read it? What would you like them to take with them afterwards?
Can
this
I go?
Time, no,
yeah. I think that there are two lessons that are in the sequels that are really powerful, and are powerful for the Force, and are powerful for all of us out there. And that is that, you know, one is that the Force is all around us. It binds us. And the second is that the Force is everybody's, and we can all use it, like just like Boom Boy at the end of 8, right? And when you bring that to our world, I think, you know, we live in a world that's, as we said, it's full of conflict. And one of the reasons it's full of conflict is because we are, as humans, are so relational. We are so interconnected. We are so tied to one another. And, you know, we have to make do the best we can with one another, with the relationships we have, with the relationships we need in order to advance. And knowing even just a little more about this can be really, really helpful in so many of our networks, relationships, endeavors in our lives. So this, it's a really important pursuit to understand a little more about this. It goes a long way in our lives. And also, it's not something that belongs to managers, business people, lawyers, you know, diplomats, people who negotiate for a living. It's any one of us. Any one of us can be just a little better at this. Any one of us can be the person who can help, you know, fix a conflict in their own environment. You know, just don't think that it's not for you.
Mm-hmm. So universalism, yes, Noam, yeah, that sounds great. Jen, how about you?
So yes, all of that. And I hope that, what people take away from the book is, an ability to start to step back and think about what is happening and why. So the book is all about, let's look at what's happening in Star Wars and why. And we could take that same perspective on our own, the conflicts in our own lives, you know, what is happening here and why, so that what we choose to do, how we choose to respond, that's a deliberate choice. It's not manipulated. It's not knee-jerk. It's purposeful. You know, it's reflective of what it is we see happening and what it is we would like to have happen. So that's my hope, that our readers take that sort of that bigger view of what's going on.
Great. That sounds awesome. Let me speak about my last question. Before we answer my last question, let me share. Hope you guys can see the cover of the book. It's straight from Amazon. It's been available for the last couple of weeks. This is how it looks like. I was hoping that it would have the inside preview, but it doesn't. Anyway, it's very appealing. You guys can buy it on Amazon. Oh, sample read right here. So, and these are the chapters that we were mm-hmm. were referring to. You guys will find a much deeper discussion than the framework of our podcast would allow us to pursue on many different topics. Absolutisms, are Jedi good mediators? Is there or should there be a gray side of force, and so on and so on. So a strong buy and read or borrow and read recommendation. And before we wrap it up, my standard question to all my guests is, oh, something changed here. The view changed. Yeah, I would like to have you guys right next to me. Who in your perception would you consider a great negotiator? From the Star Wars franchise, our contemporary world, or historical figures? I think, Noam, you've already answered this question. So let's go with Jen. But you can also revise your answer. That's also a possibility. But let's start with Jen.
A great negotiator?
Yes.
Okay, so this is I've been thinking a lot about Annie Sullivan, who is the teacher of Helen Keller. And, you know, she's not known as a negotiator. We don't study her for her negotiation. But what she was able to do is teach somebody who had become deaf and blind, she was able to teach that person how to speak and how to write and how to use language. And Helen Keller went on to be one of the most incredible thinkers and writers, and a real force for peace and a peaceful just society. And so I think that the amount of creativity and persistence and tenacity that Annie Sullivan showed in her work is something that we could all learn from.
Annie Sullivan. Thank you, Jen. Noam.
I don't want to detract from that with any, so much of what we do is helping people to talk in different ways. Probably not the way they had, often not the way they had expected to talk as they walked into the room, but to change perspective, language, framing, and then actual words and acts. And that's why I'm so moved by that example, Jenna. Forget Darth Vader. Let's go with that.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. Let's wrap it up. It's been a great pleasure to host Jen Reynolds and Noam Ebner, the authors and editors of the second of the sequel to the first episode of Star Wars and Conflict Resolution. Warm recommendation for you guys. If you haven't read it, please do. You'll find a lot of inspiration, not only for Star Wars fans or Padawans on conflict resolution and negotiation, also much beyond. You guys noticed we spoke about philosophy, life, what's good, what's evil, and so on, and how can we find ourselves working on the right side of the force. Thank you so much for being with us. Until next time on the podcast on negotiation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks.